everybody, and welcome back to Thank Godzilla, It's Final Wars. It's Final Wars, and that means it's Godzilla. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. I write for The Wrap. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I'm a senior staff writer over Slash Film, where I wrote about Godzilla today.
Very well, very well.
There are two articles about Godzilla today, because there's a new Godzilla film.
There is a new Godzilla film.
Need articles on that new one.
And we will get to Godzilla X Kong at the end of this podcast series, but if you want to jump ahead, we'll be reviewing it on the next episode of Critically Acclaimed as of this recording. If you listen to this later, it would be a while ago. That's how time works, but I digress. This is our Godzilla podcast. We have been reviewing every single Godzilla and Godzilla-adjacent movie. That second part is important here, because when we say Godzilla-adjacent movies, what we meant was movies that don't necessarily directly connect to Godzilla yet, but will connect to Godzilla later. And the majority of those movies connect to Final Wars.
This is the fulcrum. The reason we've reviewed a lot of those old movies is because the monsters show up here.
Yes.
And, of course, the whole point of this movie was a big 50th anniversary celebration.
Came out in 2004, 50 years after the debut of Gojira.
It's worth noting that Godzilla movies were tapering off in quality at this point. In fact, the whole Millennium Era could be seen as this like 5-year period where we're just sort of letting Godzilla go. It's sauntering downwards. The last couple of films weren't making a lot of money. Less and less money. People just don't care.
It was not all a complete wash. There were some good movies in that era.
There were some good movies. I like Godzilla vs. Megaguirus. I like Godzilla vs. Mechagodzilla.
Against Mechagodzilla. That's one of my favorite Godzilla movies ever, period.
Those two just have a lot of really great action in them. They're really well filmed.
Decent stories, too.
Yeah, interesting stories. They're fine Godzilla pictures.
Yeah.
But Godzilla was just sort of out. Godzilla was seen as like kind of old-fashioned.
No, it's 50 years old. It's hard for something not to feel a little passé.
So
after 50 years,
this was going to be the big finale. Yeah. It's like we're not doing anything with Godzilla anymore. We may as well go out with a bang. Yeah. So
Toho didn't say that it was dead forever, but they did say we're taking a real break after this.
Yeah, we're going to take a really long break.
It'll be 10 years. Mm-hmm. Until we get another Godzilla movie. Now, we'll review it next week. We're not going to wait 10 years. But they took 10 years before they made another Godzilla movie. There was a few random things in the middle there, and I'll talk about that at the end of the episode. But, yeah, this is a culmination. Mm. And much like all of the other films in the Millennium Era, except the last one, Godzilla...
Tokyo SOS.
Tokyo SOS. It's another reboot. It ignores everything else.
Except for Godzilla Raids Again. Weirdly, as part of the
myth. Yeah, that is weird, actually. Yeah.
This one picks it because when we finally see Godzilla an hour into this movie, literally an hour into this movie,
he's right at the beginning.
Right at the beginning.
Just before the credits, there's like 2 minutes of Godzilla, and then we have to wait another hour.
Yeah.
It's like a 2-hour movie, too. It's long for a Godzilla.
They free Godzilla from the iceberg where he had been frozen in Godzilla Raids Again. So, weirdly, that one is canon.
Well, they kind of bring it back. This movie was directed by Ryuhei Kitamura, who is a very prolific director. Not all of his movies have made the jump over here. But at the time this was made, he was kind of a rising star. Yeah. He had done a movie called Versus, which is kind of the early 2000s post-Matrix descendant of Evil Dead, and I'll explain what I mean by that. The original Evil Dead, the Sam Raimi film from the early 80s, not Evil Dead 2, was basically a whole bunch of people running around in the woods making something that looked way more like cinematic and expensive than it was, because it was just people running around in the woods with a camera. Versus is what if a bunch of Japanese gangsters went into the woods to do their murder gangster shit, but it turns out that in this woods, when you die, you come back.
Okay.
And so they can't die, and they can't keep killing each other, and there's zombies, and there's more fighting, and there's more demons. It's a very hectic movie. It came out around the time I was in film school, and everyone was very enamored of it, because...
I remember the popularity of Versus. I didn't watch it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did. I watched it several times.
Because it looked terrible?
It has an age grade, and for reasons that Final Wars hasn't aged great. But it was basically, it was very much of its time. And it was here was someone doing a lot with a little. Mm. And then he moved on. He did a few other things. He did a samurai movie I'm very fond of called Azumi, which is slick and big and has these, like, really ridiculous camera shots. Like, of just, like, flying around people as they're killing armies with their with one sword. And it's nonsense, but it's great.
He's a very energetic director, yeah. Ryuhei Kitamura. Very, very stylish, likes a very certain kind of... photography, which I think is just butt ugly. It's of its time.
It's
very much of its time. This came out in the early 2000s when there was a big move from film to digital cameras, so a lot of earlier digital cameras just didn't look good at the time.
No, the resolution wasn't there. The colors were off.
The colors were always really off.
The blacks didn't look back. You got this kind of crush where, like, early digital cameras, when it was saw like a shadow or darkness,
they didn't know what to do with it. Yeah, so they'd like throw in digital artifacts into the black space.
When you film like darkness, or when you film anything on like film, darkness is just the absence of light, so it comes off on the camera as black. But digital is picking up information, and if it doesn't see any information, it'll try to find it. So if you see like early digital shot movies, all of the blacks look really noisy.
Yeah, there's like a lot of fuzz in the blacks.
A few filmmakers did something interesting with that, but mostly they didn't.
Well, when they knew how to kind of roll with it, I feel like Richard Linklater did an experimental film called Tape, which he shot on digital cameras, and he was kind of trying to roll with that lo-fi look. Same with some of the Dogma films.
Yeah, Michael Mann in Miami Vice. Really embraced that aesthetic. I think Collateral as well.
Trying to make it...
Yeah.
Understanding that it looked kind of cheap, but trying to roll with that aesthetic.
Yeah, he got a lot out of it, actually.
There was also a tendency in films of the early 2000s to, adjust the color temperature to look really unreal.
Yeah.
Like, everything looked really blue and steely, and it just looked so bad.
Everyone was going for The Matrix.
Yeah.
That's what The Matrix came out in 1999. Kind of had
that green tint to the whole movie.
The Matrix came out in 1999, and it was not expected to be a hit. It came out, like, what, early April? Mm. Like, not blockbuster season at the time. And it was from filmmakers who had only done one low-budget thriller before then. Keanu Reeves was a known name, but he wasn't packing him into theaters.
Yeah.
Like, it was not expected to be a huge hit, but it was so stylish, so unlike anything else that had come before, and it really did some innovative things with visual effects, that it just became one of those movies that every movie reacted to. Mm. And we got this...
Including this one.
Very much. I mean that on purpose. Like, it's actually, like... When we've seen this in Godzilla before. We're like, okay, the Back to the Future movies were popular. We'll do a time travel one. The Gamera movies are popular. We're going to lighten it up and make it more kid-friendly. Here, The Matrix was a thing, and by God. Because this is Godzilla, and right at the beginning for a couple of minutes, and then the last hour to 45 is Godzilla. But that first hour, basically... It's The Matrix. It's X-Men.
There's literal mutants.
Yeah.
It's the near future. There's mutants in the future. And they're
superpowered
mutant
humans. Yeah.
And there's the shades with the long black coats. Like, they go for that. The whole tinted photography. It looks very Matrix-y.
Yeah. Action sequences that look very similar to things we'd seen in The Matrix. Yeah. Like the highway fight and everything. Yeah.
It's rare that a Godzilla film will so have... Like, you mentioned Godzilla versus... King Ghidorah from 1991 was a time travel movie because Back to the Future Part 2 was a big hit in Japan.
Yeah. And Terminator 2 was a big deal as well. There's a Terminator character in that movie.
So they said, why don't we do something with time travel? It's a little wild, but we'll go for it. And I actually happen to like that movie a lot.
It's ridiculous, but it's very fun.
It's rare, though, that like the success of an American film influenced a Godzilla picture. That much. And this one especially feels... And there's a Star Wars sequence in this one as well.
Yeah.
Where they break into the Death Star, which is actually the Zillion's like egg-shaped ship.
Yeah.
Just all of these American influences are floating through this one. And it's... as such, it doesn't feel like a Godzilla movie. It feels like...
I think...
You know what it feels like? It feels like an overblown, like, fan film. I want to throw in all the references I can. And that's what Ryuhei Kitamura did. From what I understand, the filmmakers got together. They said, we want to throw in as many monsters as we possibly can. And they started literally playing with Godzilla toys.
Oh, yeah.
And arranging them on a table to see which, like... Oops. Sorry, dropping stuff. Which lineup looked the best. Like, yeah. Which monsters looked best, like, standing all next to
each other. I mean, you can't put literally all of them in there. We won't have enough movie for that. So they made their choices based on aesthetics. And
but it's the most of them. We got King Caesar in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
We
get Angerus is finally back.
Angerus is finally back and gets to do, like, the Gamera thing where he's, like, flying through the air and stuff.
I will say this. Angerus gets his time in the sun.
Yeah.
It's been way too long, and Angerus finally got some shit to do, and I was very happy about that.
Of course, we get a Mothra back. We get
Rodan.
Rodan is back.
Yeah.
Kamakuras and Kumonga, the bugs from Son of Godzilla.
Yeah.
Minilla is back.
Hedra is back. Briefly.
Hedra is back. Yeah. Which is pretty cool. And most surprisingly, the 1998 American Godzilla is in the movie. That's kind of the most notorious scene from our perspective.
Apparently, they were originally
Americans.
They were originally going to do the Gorosaurus, which was more of like their version of like a T-Rex, if you'll recall.
Yeah.
And then they found out they could get
the TriStar,
the TriStar version. Yeah. They're like, okay, well, we got it. Mm. So they did. No, we get it's a big monster mash. Like they get most of the prominent monsters in there, and a few of the obscure ones as well. And Godzilla's going to fight them all.
Yeah, we got two versions of Gigan.
Yeah. We got Mondo.
Mondo, also very briefly.
At the beginning, Godzilla doesn't fight him, but cool sequence.
Mm-hmm.
I will say this about this movie. When it finally does monster shit, I was on board.
Okay.
I was having a good time. And honestly, I was watching this and I was thinking to myself, this is so shamelessly early 2000s post-Matrix. This is dated so much. I'm not even going to say badly, just a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, oh, it's of its time. On the other hand, a lot of the Godzilla movies, especially in the Showa era, and the other monster movies that we've covered as well, did feel like we were making whatever the hell movie we wanted, and we shoved the monsters into the third act.
Yeah.
You know, that was Doggera with its diamond heists. That was Mothra with its Mothra versus Godzilla with its amusement park egg thing. Okay. You know, like there's a lot of the time it felt like they were trying to make any movie they could, and they could get that movie made because eventually there would be a monster fight in it.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that this movie is almost annoyingly topical for its time, and I think our condescension of that era, a little warranted. There was a lot of shallow knockoffs of the Matrix and X-Men and stuff at the time, but also that was our era, and I think we're a little embarrassed by it, to be fair. Like, we were watching those movies. We paid to see Underworld. Like, that's on us. Like, that's our fault that we got five of those.
We did, we did make those films hits. That's true. Here's the thing. Even at the time, though, we criticized them. We thought they weren't very good movies.
But they were popular. They were popular.
I don't care if they're popular. They're bad. I'm not talking about their popularity.
I'm just talking about historical relevance.
Yeah. So those kinds of films were popular at the time. Godzilla tried to fall in line with those. And just in so doing, made another bad one of those things.
Sure. And again, I just think that is, to be fair, even though it's very much early 2000s, it is of a piece with a lot of Godzilla movies in terms of its basic structure.
It's basic structure, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's of a piece. It's just a knockoff. It's taking story elements, characters, and actors from all throughout Godzilla history and just rehashing them in a way that isn't bringing the new light to them, isn't doing them in any kind of a better or more interesting way than the originals did. It's just sort of echoing a lot of dialogue from dialogue, plot elements, and things we might recognize in a, hey, I recognize that sort of way. It's the non-comedy equivalent of those Friedberg Seltzer movies, where you're supposed to just get a thrill from recognizing something.
A little bit, yeah.
Without the film having to do or say anything interesting about what they're referencing.
I think there's a cinematic tradition of that, though, with long-running series where you do an anniversary movie, it's going to be full of references. Remember when Die Another Day came out, and it was, I think that was like the 50th anniversary of Bond or something.
Yeah, all these gadgets in it.
And there was a specific reference to every single Bond film.
Yeah.
Whether it was we literally see the jetpack from Thunderball or Madonna is like wearing diamonds or something and she says diamonds are forever, Ewan. Oh.
Yeah. You note how that's not a good movie either.
Well, I agree. I'm not saying it's great. But that's kind of
bugged me about one of the elements that bugged me about Avengers Endgame.
Sure.
It's like they're literally traveling back in time to movies you saw before.
And it's their own movies as well.
It's their own movies.
Because
yeah,
at least Ryuhei Kitamura is like, you know, taking stuff from 50 years of movies he didn't make.
Yeah.
I think there's a genuine fandom for a lot of this stuff. He said he wasn't like particularly into like the 90s and 2000s Godzilla movies. He wasn't a fan of what had been being done with them, but he still seems to have affection for it.
Yeah.
And I think this kind of anniversary fan service, though, I think it's gotten better. I look at when they did like the 50th anniversary Doctor Who.
Okay.
And they had, you know, multiple doctors team up. And
like all
had,
the, all like, the living yeah. actors and got
it,
back together.
And this incredible culminating scene where, thanks to the magic of editing and repurposed footage, all of the doctors teamed up to save the day at the end. And I'm sorry, I'm not above this. I rewatched that scene alone multiple times and cried.
Oh, you sucker.
It was handled well. It can be handled well, is my point.
Here's the thing. Maybe I'm just a cold-hearted bastard. But even with things I like really care about, the shows that I'm watching and the film series I'm following, when they do that, it always strikes me as completely disingenuous because they're not doing it because they have an interesting story to tell. Or they're trying to do something kind for the characters. They're doing something for me, and I don't want them to do something for me.
That's how selfless of you.
I suppose so. Maybe I'm not that kind of fan, I suppose. I don't know. I've never responded to that kind of
stuff. What about, I can't remember which one it was, the Deep Space Nine Trouble with Tribbles episode. That was the anniversary fan service episode.
And it was cute.
Yes, it's very cute. Just like all the Tribbles episodes.
Yeah.
To be fair.
But, you know, I don't look back at that episode and think, wow, what an event, or that really touched me, or I'm glad they threw that in.
Well, but that one
there,
was fun,
you know?
Though. Like, that one did what it needed to do, right?
It wasn't, like, a big finale. It was partway through the season.
Yeah, fair enough.
And it's...
It doesn't take on dramatic weight. It's a lark.
It's treated like a lark. It's actually a very light episode. I think I appreciate when they're treating it light.
Ah, that's fair. That's a fair point, Well, in any case, that's what we're doing here.
Yeah, we're just doing it. We're hauling them all out of mothballs and muffler balls. The story is taken from Godzilla versus Astro Monster,
Invasion of Astro Monster.
Yeah,
the main setup is it's the
aliens from Planet X, the Zillions,
or as the as they're pronounced in the American dub of this, Exilians. You may recall the Exilians showed up and they were like, "Hey, can we borrow your monsters?" And then after we generously donated Godzilla and Rodan to them and abandoned them.
On the moon.
As they were like, "Hey, what the hell, you guys?" And then they're like, "I actually feel kind of bad." They said this. "I feel kind of bad for Godzilla and Rodan." That was one of the first times humans sympathized with them. Because even they were like, "We kind of fucked them over." And then the Exilians took those monsters and King Ghidorah, and they just attacked Earth, and we were helpless without our monsters.
Yeah, if you see an alien in a Godzilla movie, they have a means to control monsters, and they're going to use them to take over the world. That's... reliable as the tides.
Yeah. So the Exilians are going to show up, but to be clear, they show up in an alternate version of our reality. In addition to monsters are just real and running around, and Godzilla is the most indestructible one, but there's a whole bunch. And we have created, once again, a special force that exists exclusively to destroy monsters. The Earth Defense Forces, sort of United Nations of Monster Hunters. Very Pacific Rim of us. And our main weapons against the giant monsters, the kaiju, is the flying submarine from Atragon.
Yeah.
Now that's cool.
I appreciate it. Well, I mean, it's cool. It's cool to see these things again, but knowing that they're just sort of... Have you ever bought groceries in bulk? You open like a big barrel and you scoop stuff. I feel like that's what they're doing with Godzilla references. They're just scooping things out into a bin.
I feel like there's a certain, when you're doing this kind of a retelling or reboot of like a whole mythology canon, whatever, there comes a point where you're telling your story and you have to make a creative decision. You have to include a character or a monster or a piece of technology. And you have two options. You can either make something new, or you can see if they already did that.
Uh-huh.
So if we're going to need like a cool like vehicle for people to attack Godzilla's in,
may as well draw on one of the cool ones they already
have. We've
already
invented a whole bunch of them. We might as well just use it. And, like, just, it's part of, like, the, just part of the vernacular, the vocabulary that we have. Okay. And honestly, going back to Atragon rather than going back to, like, Mogera or something, that's fun. We haven't gone back to Atragon in a long time. We haven't seen Manda, I think, since Destroy All Monsters.
Yeah, since Destroy All Monsters. Yeah. It's been a second.
Yeah.
I like, okay, fair. The use of Atragon was
pretty
novel.
I think it was cool. Yeah.
From what I understand, the filmmakers also wanted to have either Mogera or Kiryu / Mechagodzilla, but they just used it in two movies in a row, and they said that's overkill. So they decided not to have Mechagodzilla in this movie.
It's fine. Godzilla had its time in the sun. I think we can bet that. Why am I using that expression so much this week? But anyway. At the beginning of the movie, there is a captain, and the dude looks like Zangief from Street Fighter 2.
Well, and he's like a real MMA fighter.
He's an MMA fighter and a wrestler who actually wrestled in Japan.
Yeah, his name is Donald Fry is his name. Yeah.
And he's got a great...
A.K.A. The Predator.
Yeah.
That was his ring name.
He's got...
And there's a line of dialogue to that effect. So they used to call me the Predator because that was his nickname.
And I'm not going to call him a great actor or anything like that, but he's got presence. Like, he stands there and he fills the room. Mm. He's got this big mustache. He's got this giant frame.
So they cast wrestlers and MMA fighters in movies. They're big.
They're
a lot of presence holding men,
especially in wrestling
and women as well.
Yeah. And especially in wrestling, you know, there's so much theatricality to that.
Yeah.
That there's often like a certain like natural on-screen charisma depending on what their range is. Not picking up on a lot of range from this guy, but he definitely looks intimidating. He looks, I think he might have even, I wasn't able to track it down and confirm that this is true. I think he might have played Mayor Hagar in like a Final Fight fan film. If you recall, Mayor Hagar, he was this big muscly mustachioed mayor of a city that was overrun by crime. And Mayor Hagar decided, okay, I'm going to clean up the city myself. And he rips off his shirt and takes to the streets and just beats up criminals. And that's the whole game. It's just you're the mayor beating up criminals.
Fry portrayed the mayor and former wrestler Mike Hagar in the Final Fight fan film called The Broken Gear.
Yeah.
So if you want to look up The Broken Gear, you can see this guy.
Yeah. And he honestly looks just like him. It's perfect casting, to be fair. He plays, like, the tough, take-no-shit captain. And this will be important later, that he's a rebel. And at the beginning of the movie, he is... I forget, do they fight Manda first, or are they fighting Godzilla first?
Manda's first.
Okay, no. No, it is Godzilla. Sorry, right at the beginning, it's the Atragon... I think they call it something else, but they're finding Godzilla, and they're finding Godzilla at the South Pole, and Godzilla is not responding well to their attacks, but they are able to bury him in ice, just like at the end of Godzilla Raids Again. This whole sequence, Godzilla is mostly just standing there, minding his own goddamn business. At which point, there's a big montage and it explains there are a whole bunch of monsters. Here are the defense forces. Oh, by the way. Lately, in the last few decades, a lot of people have been born with a mutant gene. So we have recruited them to our monster fighting force. So they all wear dark leather. And there's a lot of red armbands, and it's got a very Nazi-esque vibe. So you know this isn't going to go well.
That was a weird sort of twist in that sort of aesthetic look that they gave to like The Matrix.
Yeah.
That sort of... Part of it was like sort of priestly. They kind of rolled into the priestly garb in the Matrix sequels a little bit more.
Yeah, those long robes with like the seam down the front,
kind of like the sealed collar up front.
Yeah,
but a lot of that aesthetic did have this kind of fascist vibe to it, which was really weird because the Freedom Fighters tended to wear that outfit.
Yeah, like the Matrix is about shirking the system. It's about it's as anti-fascist as it can get, basically. Mm. But yet they're
wearing fascist uniforms and those big stompy boots. And keep in mind...
I think the Matrix is skirting the edge, but when you watch this movie, you realize how close it is.
Yeah. Keep in mind, a lot of sort of the punk rock look, like the leather jackets and the big stompy boots, was deliberately taken from skinheads. The skinhead punk rock, like, kind of overlap was a little stronger than some people care to admit. But punk rockers...
There's also a lot of direct refutation of it within the punk community.
Well, exactly. Yeah. A big part of the punk scene was actually co-opting and turning those images into acts of rebellion. Yeah. The opposite of what it was intended as.
Nazi punks fuck off.
Yeah. So, if you're a punker, you're anti-Nazi. There's no such thing as a Nazi punk.
Yeah.
The Nazis are the system. The punks stomp on your face.
Is Sum 41 punk?
Oh, that's right, there's a Sum 41 song in this fucking movie.
I'm watching this movie. But it's not just that there's a song. I'm watching this movie, I'm watching the opening credits, and there's a lot of clip show, like, oh, and here's a shot of Varan, who's still not back, but by God, we're using the clips. And then, like, you know, the title of the movie and the director of the movie, and then I just see giant on screen Sum 41, as if they're starring in it. It's not even, like, later, like, with a special song by, like, no. Right up front. Sum 41 was kind of a big deal at the time. I know, really, they're still kind of a big deal, but they were new. They were very hip. They were very now. They were very wild.
They were one of those many bands that, you know, Blink 182, Matchbox 26. Yeah. You know, it was cool to put a number in your band.
Yeah. And much like
Seven Mary Three, that kind of stuff.
And much like Godzilla, they stormed through the party like their name was El Nino.
Good. Sum 41 reference.
Thank you very much.
That only the members of Sum 41 who are listening to this podcast would understand.
Look, I think it's fair to say that I'm in too deep.
People didn't get that one either.
Okay. Someone got it. And I'm very happy. It's fine.
Your Sum 41 lyrics just aren't landing today.
You know what? I'm very fine with that. I'm not a big fan. If you love Sum 41, it's fine. That's not my point. It's just... It's sometimes the special guest in the movie dates the movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, oh, okay, well.
Hey, look, everyone, it's Smash Mouth.
Yeah, exactly. From, when does Smash Mouth show up?
Rat Race. They're actually in Rat Race.
Or when Sugar Ray was actually in Scooby-Doo.
Right.
A live action movie, as themselves.
In one of the Scary Movie films, they're... The one that was spoofing Spielberg's War of the Worlds.
Oh.
People were drawn up into the ships.
I think it was four.
Yeah. People were drawn up into the ships and they're looking around. It's like, they're taking everybody. Look, there's Chingy. Remember Chingy? No, nobody remembers Chingy.
No, I don't remember Chingy. I don't even know I'm going to be pronouncing that correctly.
Chingy, I'm one of those.
No,
Chingy, Chingy, yeah.
No idea. I'm glad they got their paycheck.
Yeah.
Good for them.
And there's Chingy and in the spaceship.
And to be fair, movies have been doing that for forever. That wasn't like of an era. You look at like movies in the 60s and the 70s and they'll just have, oh, by the way, here's Charo. Like, oh, right. Okay. I mean, no disrespect to Charo, but...
I love Charo.
No disrespect to Charo, but nowadays you'd have to explain who Charo was.
I suppose so.
At the time it was like, oh, hey, Charo's here, you know? Okay, cool, yeah. Different vibe. So Sum 41 was so popular that not only did they have a song on the soundtrack, and it plays during the fight between Godzilla and the American Godzilla, that they're heavily in the opening credits, like with a giant title card all to themselves. I don't even think it explains what they did. It just says Sum 41. It's hilarious. So we cut to, after we have successfully neutralized Godzilla for way too long, our heroes are once again in their submarine spaceship. And now they're fighting Manda. And Manda is this, as you might recall, is this cool, long, spindly dragon.
Serpent,
and it, like, wraps itself around the submarine. Oh, God, I love Manda. Manda is one of my favorites. If you might have noticed, I have my favorites. Angris, Manda.
Mm-hmm.
Probably my top two. I just love them to pieces.
It's all about Mechagodzilla for me.
I'm totally fine with that. But I love the design of Manga, and I love everything about Angris. And, So they fight Manda, and like, oh no. and they burn Manda in an underwater volcano, which seems like a bit much, but all right, that's fine. Also, they drill into it. They freeze it, and then they throw it into a volcano. Then they freeze it with their maser, which was not the Absolute Zero weapon. You're getting them confused.
But it's a 2-for-1 reference.
Sure.
You get to call it the Mazer, but have it be the absolute zero ray.
Yeah. And then they drill through it with their submarine, which is cool. And then we cut to two guys we don't really know wearing identical clothing in a metal room, sparring and fighting.
I was reminded of Pacific Rim.
Sure.
Which has, believe it or not, two separate characters in it, even though you would swear they're the same guy.
The dude from...
The two main white guys are, like, indistinguishable in that movie. I don't even
think there are two main white guys in that movie.
There are, and they look identical. There's the brother, and there's the main guy, right?
But the brother dies in, like, the opening scene.
Yeah, but then he comes back.
No, he doesn't! What are you talking about? He dies, that's the plot!
It's the plot, but then he's back, and it took me the bulk of the movie to realize that was a different character.
No. What's the guy?
It's like Charlie Hunnam or something?
Charlie Hunnam. Yeah. Charlie Hunnam, at the beginning of Pacific Rim, he is drift compatible with his own brother, and his own brother dies fighting a monster. Mm. And then later on, he needs to come back because they're running out of Jaeger pilots, and he needs to find a co-pilot, but he doesn't get another white guy. He gets Michael Morey.
There's like a Russian younger guy.
Maybe you're thinking of him.
I think so.
Or maybe you're thinking of Charlie Day, but I don't think they look alike, so I don't think that works.
Is Charlie Day in that movie?
Charlie Day was one of the scientists. Him and Byrne.
I've seen that movie a couple times. It's out of my mind. It's so bad. Pacific Rim is a terrible
film. I really like the original Pacific Rim a lot. I think you're just a big old asshole.
I liked it more when I first saw it, and the more I've watched it, the more I realize it's just a terrible picture.
Anyway, they've been fighting each other, and one guy is like, you know, kind of cool and likable, and the other guy's a big old jerk who believes that mutants were created to fight stuff and be superior and shit, and this will be important later. Our good guy mutant is enlisted to be the bodyguard for a scientist who is a woman. So there will be some tension. And that's basically where that goes. Also, they find an ancient cyborg from outer space, mummified. It turns out it's Gigan.
It's Gigan from outer space.
Oh, this will definitely be important later. This is awesome.
And it's a cooler, pointier Gigan.
It's
all super sharpened with bigger hooks.
You might recall that Gigan had hooks for arms, which makes it very difficult to pick your nose. And in this version, he has double chainsaws for arms.
Yeah.
Awesome. And a lot harder to pick your nose. So just don't do it.
Luckily, Gigan has no nostrils, so I think...
Then how does he smell?
Terrible!
Ah! Okay.
How does he get mucus out of his body?
Terrible!
Just hacks a lot of loogies.
Anyway.
I'm sorry I said that.
No, you're fine. Also, there's an important subplot with a UN Secretary General. It's the first Japanese UN Secretary General the UN's ever had, apparently. And there's an interview with him, and he seems like a nice guy, and he talks about his dog a lot. This will be important later. A lot of
these characters, by the way, are played by, like, Godzilla veterans.
Yes.
Who are coming back from whatever movie they could get. Some are just from Tokyo, as recently as Tokyo SOS, but playing different characters.
Sure.
But some are going back to, like, the 60s. Yeah. Like, some of them are returning.
That's cool.
You'd have to look them up to get all of them, because there's, like, a dozen cameos from, like, various...
I think there's even some cameos in the Millennium Era as well. It's just a ton of cameos.
There was a cameo from one of the actresses from one of the previous Godzilla movies playing herself now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, wasn't she, like an interviewer or something?
There's an interview with an actress playing herself, and she's playing the actress who was in a Godzilla movie.
That's fine. All right, so a whole bunch of shit is happening all at once. The scientists are trying to figure out what's up with Gigan. The fairies from Infant Island show up to explain the premise of Gigan. So that's kind of a big deal. They even transport them to a Mothra altar to explain that Mothra defeated Gigan like 12,000 years ago.
Which was the plot of one of the Rebirth of Mothra movies, if you recall.
It wasn't Gigan, it was Geeter in that one. Otherwise the same, yeah. And also, incidentally, you know those mutants you've got now? These, like, super-powered, cool guys in leather? And they wear body armor, but the body armor has big holes in it for some reason, and I can't figure out why. They have Gigan DNA in them. Gigan was, like... Its DNA was, like, filtering through the Earth. And it's got these, like, it's like, you know, we talked about how there's different, there's four different components in DNA, GATC,
yeah.
Adenine, guanine, thymine, and cytosine? How did I do? Someone knows science better than I do. But it turns out there's also a letter M, and that we get that from Gigan, and mutants have the M gene instead of the X gene.
Gattacam.
Yeah. Gamatica.
That's not grammatically correct.
while we're getting all of these, all of this exposition, the movie kicks into high gear briefly, and I'm very grateful for it, and a whole bunch of monsters attack all at once, like all over the planet, very Destroy All Monsters style. Zilla, who is the American version of Godzilla, technically speaking, for legal reasons, the 1998 American Godzilla, when they're referring to it basically like in America or referring to that movie, that's Godzilla. But in the Toho universe, the monster that looks like that is called Zilla.
It's a different monster.
Based on the joke, they took the god out of Godzilla. That attacks, I think, Sydney.
Sydney, yeah.
Yeah. Rodan
shows up right at the beginning in New York.
Yep. King Caesar shows up in Okinawa.
I think King Caesar's first. And well, then regardless. It's Zilla, but yeah.
Anguirus shows up in Shanghai. Mm. The giant spiders show up in Arizona.
Which I like to think is a reference to the Jack Arnold movie Tarantula.
Or possibly because
that took place in Arizona.
Yeah. The mantises show up in Paris. Ebera, the lobster, who we have not seen since Ebera, Horror of the Deep, so it's nice to have Ebera back, attacks a power plant in Tokyo. And also, by the way, Manila is in this, which I didn't even realize.
I said that, yeah.
I tuned it out, though. And
I know, nobody listens to me, it's fine.
But it's weird that Manila shows up now, or they think it's called Mila in this one, but it's weird.
I think they say Minya in the American dub.
But yeah, he's been called a bunch of things. But why is that one showing up now? Because at no point in this movie is that an evil monster. Not mind-controlled or otherwise. It's just the cute one.
Hmm.
And it immediately finds, like, a plucky young boy and his grandfather, who's, like, a hunter covered in, like, you know, animal skins. And they find this little monster, and they name it, and they get in a car with it and take a road trip to find Godzilla, which will ultimately culminate in the last scene of the movie.
Yeah, Manila plays a kind of a key role in the climax of the movie to save the people.
But the rest of it is just him getting to the climax.
Manila can also change size, like in All Monsters Attack.
Yeah.
Manila also looks terrible.
It never looked good.
Yeah, like, better than in the 60s, but still looks terrible.
Yeah.
At
least it doesn't have that horrible human voice it had in All Monsters Attack.
That's true.
Like, oof.
And especially the English language dub was even worse.
Exactly what I mean.
But I love this interpretation of Final Wars. The son of Godzilla holds his arms out to both sides and says, "Humanity is worth saving. Do not be vengeful."
Now, you realize you just made this movie more powerful.
Ryuhei Kitamura's religious beliefs, or if that was done on purpose, or if that's just kind of
it's
a coincidence.
In the text. Yeah, it's in the text. That's a fair read. Anyway, all of those things attack. The only one that the human beings get a chance to really like fight off is Ebera, the lobster. And so they're running
around.
That's
a long sequence with Ebera. Ebera's redesigned. All the monsters are kind of redesigned for this one. Try to make them look a lot more sleek. The suit actors have a lot more movement.
And by the way, this is the last Godzilla movie we're going to get, which is mostly
suit actors.
Yeah, there's a few characters are CG. Zilla is the only character who is entirely CG throughout the movie. A few characters are CG sometimes.
The mantises, the Kamakuras, are CG when they're like flying around.
So sometimes they're CG, but there's the definite commitment to portraying most of these monsters most of the time as people in cool suits, and I appreciate that.
Yeah,
that's a classy thing to do. They're fighting this giant lobster, and when they've got the lobster like on the ropes, the one mutant says like a cool action line. But it made no sense to me whatsoever. As they're defeating Ebera, The guy says, sorry, I'm a vegetarian.
It says it in English, too.
Yeah, yeah. Or did you see the original subtitle version?
I did.
Okay, see, I saw the dub version.
In the Japanese version, he says that line in English.
And here's the thing. People are usually vegetarians because they like animals, not because they want to kill them. He's killing a giant lobster right now and saying, sorry, I'm a vegetarian, well, clearly, so I may murder you, clearly, but I won't eat you, and that's my gesture of respect.
Clearly you didn't grow up watching animated commercials on television of anthropomorphic food items longing to be consumed by children. I'm an anthropomorphic string cheese. I'm going to find this child. I want him to eat me. I need him to consume of my flesh.
Okay, I watched the same commercials you did, and I do not remember that shit at all.
That happened a lot. There were, like, anthropomorphic food
items. I remember anthropomorphic food. I don't remember them demanding to be... I don't remember the California Raisins singing and dancing cool songs, then jumping into someone's mouth and going, wee, as they were masticated.
In one of their ads, they're singing and dancing along, like, somebody's nightstand, because they're having a snack.
Yeah.
And they cut to, like, the human scale, and they're picking them up and eating them.
I'm just saying...
Because they are raisins.
Put yourself in Ebera's claws for a second. Like, put yourself in, like, his rubber bands.
Oh, I do that every day.
Put yourself in Ebera's rubber bands. Imagine someone is murdering you.
Okay.
Like, literally, like, killing you.
Hmm.
And the last thing you hear before you die is them saying, as they're killing you, sorry, I'm not a cannibal. You would die a little confused. It'd be like, that is not what's most relevant right now.
You know, if I were a lobster and I realized how delicious I was with drawn butter... Mm-hmm. I would probably think, well, I'm being murdered, but at least they'll have a nice feast of me. And then if the last thing I heard was, I'm not even going to eat
you. What is this, the giving lobster?
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's a strange, stupid line. There's a line earlier when Zilla was being killed. They also said, I knew that fish-eating monster would never get... Which is a reference to...
He eats a lot of fish.
Eating a lot of fish in the American movie.
They call him in the American dub, I think, Tuna Head.
Tuna Head.
I knew that Tuna Head wasn't up too much. Which is not a great line under any circumstances.
like the Japanese subtitle translation better.
All right, anyway, the other big plot point that happens during this monster attack is the plane carrying the UN Secretary General, I told you this would be important, blows up. And everyone thinks he's dead. And then all of a sudden...
This thing comes out of his neck.
Later.
Oh. I thought you were talking about that scene.
No, later on. That stuff happens later. But in the meantime, also, suddenly all the monsters vanish. And then this UFO shows up, and it's the Exilians. And they're wearing cool leather and weird sunglasses, which, to be fair, is a reference to the original.
Yeah, where they wear the same weird sunglasses.
Yeah. And they say, hey, we're here, we're from far away. We're aliens. Well, we're ex-aliens, I guess. You're welcome. We just took care of your monster problem. See, we're nice. We're here to help out. We're here to be your friends. We have saved your UN Secretary General. He's now on our side and wants to form an alliance with us. Everything is great. In fact, we're even going to try to protect you from this giant rogue planet that's going to collide with Earth called Gorath.
It's back.
Yeah. So that's a reference too.
No, no sign of the walrus monster, but you know.
No. Well, you can't have everything, can you? And everyone's like, oh, this is so great. Oh, I love these ex-aliens. And they're like doing publicity. They're like on the radio.
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, they probably would.
That's one of the dated elements, because the way they treat fame and the proliferation of that kind of thing.
It's very, it's a combination of two things. It's very V, which was huge in the 80s, and they briefly brought it back for a reboot, but it didn't have the same impact.
Yeah.
But V was a sci-fi series. It started off as a miniseries, became a TV series afterwards.
The miniseries is great.
It was very popular. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but basically, aliens show up. And they're nice.
And they say, we've come because we need your help. We're running out of resources.
Yeah.
But they begin infiltrating, like, every level of government and very...
Yeah.
Start becoming fascists on Earth.
Instead of just conquering the Earth like War of the Worlds, they decide to infiltrate us like right in front of our eyes.
Yeah.
And
they start putting up alien propaganda. Yeah. The visitors are your friends. And yeah. Of course, through an investigation, we learn, A, they don't look like humans. They're wearing really human masks.
Scary monsters. Yeah.
And also they eat human meat and they eat like rodents and stuff. There's a really terrifying scene of a woman eating a guinea pig that burned its way into my nightmare.
Oh, that was a very big deal, that one. But the other one that is clearly someone involved in the production was into it was it's very To Serve Man.
Yeah.
Which is an early Twilight Zone episode. Well, actually it wasn't early. It was a later Twilight Zone episode, but it was back in the 60s is my point. The original Twilight Zone. In which aliens led by Richard Kiel, who was Jaws in the James Bond movies, and also Iga. They're these big, giant aliens with big brains, and they say, we're here to help. We're here to serve man. And they have a book with them called To Serve Man. Yeah. And it's like, oh, this is great. They're here to help us, and they're really nice. They improve all our technology. And they start, like, you know, opening, like, transport, and people can go to their planet, and everyone's just loving it. Society is great. But there's a couple of people who are super skeptical, and they managed to get a copy of this book, and they're trying to translate it. Maybe we can learn more about them. Maybe there's more to know than they're telling us, no matter how magnanimous they seem. And I'm going to give a spoiler alert for, like, a 60-year-old episode of The Twilight Zone, but it is a classic. So if you want to jump ahead a minute, go for it. All right? You good? Giving you a chance? You're done. The twist is they find out To Serve Man is a cookbook. One of the great twists. And with the episodes like kind of short, like you can get away with that. You know, yeah. If it was 2 hours long, we'd kind of be ahead of it, but like it works so well. So we're waiting for the other shoe to drop with these Exilians, and our heroes are very suspicious. And indeed, the scientist's sister, her sister is the reporter who interviewed the Secretary General at the beginning, and as they are investigating, they realize that the Secretary General no longer blinks. Which is it's subtle enough that not everyone picks up on it, but once you notice it, you're like, oh shit, that's alien shit. That's not great. And indeed, she like interviews him and the Exilians, and she tricks him by like saying like, oh well, you talked about your dog in your last interview. She opens up a dog carrier, and a dog shows up, and the guy's like, Oh, yeah, my dog. Oh, what was your dog's name? Oh,
dog.
It's been so long. And she's like, your dog's name was Clint. You said its name was Clint. Yeah, Clint. This is my dog, Clint. And she said, I actually never said that was your dog. That's my dog. And he's like, ah, shit.
You tricked me.
And then the Exilians basically go, all right, fuck it. Yeah, we're evil. Well, one of the guys tries to brush it off. Oh. And then his hot-headed son kills the guy, or the next in line or something, kills him in live TV, and says, no, fuck it, we're evil, I hated this whole infiltration plan, we're gonna kill everybody. Also, we're psychically controlling all the mutants, which is bad.
Yeah.
And
we can teleport monsters, it's all us.
It's gonna be real bad. And so, our scientist, a couple of random characters who we've met over the years, one mutant, very specifically, cannot be mind-controlled, and they don't know why. And it's our hero mutant who was her bodyguard.
Hmm.
This will be important later. And they decide, who can we trust? Well, the only person we know we can trust is Zangief, is Mayor Hagar, because Mayor Hagar has been in the brig this entire time for punching at a superior officer. That's how rebellious he is. So they break him out, and they hand him a samurai sword, and they start going to town, and there's a huge fucking fight.
I want to stop you here. I would really like us to skip ahead, because this crap is death.
It is.
All of this stuff is just, it slows the pace of the movie.
It sounds exciting and fast-paced, right? It isn't.
It isn't. These things are presented really awkwardly.
Yeah.
It brings a lot of the monster mayhem to a crashing halt.
Yeah. It's all padded. Like, it doesn't need, you could tell this exact same part of the story in 20 minutes, and it takes an hour.
The music is just all over the place. It's really overblown.
Yeah.
It just becomes such a grind. This movie's a chore to get through. It's just so
at
difficult.
Least until the monsters finally come back. But yeah, there's like,
but by then it's like you're worn down. You're not excited anymore.
There's a whole bunch of fighting and stuff, and theoretically it should be cool, but it's not. There's one exception to this rule, and it's
the chainsaw guy again.
No, I'm not. Monsters are a separate thing. I'm talking about before the monsters. There's one cool thing in the middle with all of this Exilion mutant infiltration.
I really hope you're not going to say the motorcycle chase.
It's part of the motorcycle chase.
Okay. Because that motorcycle chase is part of this death.
Okay, so they're escaping. Some people are escaping in a truck, but the hero mutant is on a motorcycle, and the evil mutant who he sparred with earlier is also on a motorcycle, and they're chasing each other, and they're like, it's like
fight on a bridge.
Yeah, and they're shooting at each other, all cool and slow mo like, and it's kind of like the motorcycle chase at the end of Mission Impossible 2, but also the highway chase in The Matrix Reloaded.
It's all CG though. It's not like
it looks very fake.
Practical motorcycle effects outdoors. That like. I think it's like digital matte paintings and stuff.
Yeah. It just looks really bad. And it's washed out, and it just doesn't look stylish at all. It's not great.
Okay.
Except for one part. And I have realized this. This is something that I didn't know was my kink. But it turns out that if you put this in a movie, I will giggle with glee. If you roundhouse kick someone with a motorcycle...
You're going to spin it around on one wheel and whack someone in the face with the other. Yeah.
I'm into it.
That happened to the movie Torque as well.
The Torque did it best.
Yes.
No one has done it better, but I have seen it done since. And I think this actually predates Torque. I think this is the only time I've seen it done that predates Torque. Bless them for that.
Nothing predates Torque. Torque is the inception of cinema.
Yes, so, honestly, yes, that's true.
Except for Gremlins 2.
We should do a Torque podcast. Every week we watch Torque. Torque kicks ass. Torque is great.
My favorite part is when he drives the motorcycle so fast
that
a parking meter gets angry and explodes. Something that happens in the movie.
Yeah. Oh, Torque came out the same year, so it's probably concurrent. I don't know which one came out first. There was a Torque TV series.
What?
It might just be the same title. I don't think it has anything to do with it. What? Anyway, I digress. No, anyway, different thing. Different thing. Just had the same name. Okay, I got excited for a second. I was like,
Some of the mutants have zillion
DNA. They all have zillion DNA. They all have zillion DNA, and they've all turned on humanity.
They call them Kaisers, which is like a different kind of super mutant. They can take over their brains.
Yeah. That's later. That's a big reveal, actually, that there's a subset of mutants.
Yeah.
Called Kaisers. It's like back in the 90s when you found out that some of the X-Men were called Externals, and they lived forever.
Oh, I don't remember that. Yeah.
Cannonball was one of those. Remember Cannonball from the New Mutants?
You know, I really don't care.
And I was very confused because I get what you're getting at. Eternals, right? I get it. Externals. But External is a different word.
Yes.
External isn't like a made-up nonsense word that you created as a portmanteau.
I remember Sam Guthrie, Cannonball from X-Force. Yes, I remember the character.
Good times. Anyway, all of the monsters are going to come back. They're like, fuck it, unleash all the monsters. We're just going to the whole plan is to turn humanity into cattle so the Exilians can eat them. And so they were going to try to make it like, let's get them to like sort of be complacent and we'll ease them into this. And it'll take a little longer, but it'll be a lot less stressful for everybody. And the young hothead kills the main Exilian and he's like, nope, fuck it. We're going to do it the fast way. So we're going to get all the monsters and we're going to attack everybody. And now it's up to like 6 humans to save the entire planet. And the only solution they have is... we're going to have to free Godzilla. Because Godzilla...
We're into this movie. We're finally getting to Godzilla.
Because Godzilla is, unlike the other monsters who they can control, doesn't have the Gigan gene in it. So Godzilla can't be controlled. That's their thin excuse. They go to the Antarctic, they bust Godzilla out, and Godzilla, who apparently has not been aware of the passage of time, thinks he's still fighting them. So he's trying to kick their butts. And so their plan is, we're going to fly all around the globe... and Godzilla's going to chase after us, and we're going to lead Godzilla to all the monsters to kill. And now we're having fun!
That's the second half of the movie, is they fly from city to city, Godzilla chases them, Godzilla runs into the monsters, kills them one by one.
And you know what? From this point on, I mostly had a good time. Godzilla was fighting monsters, at least it was cool. So Godzilla, first up, Godzilla fights Zilla. Sum 41 song plays for about 10 seconds. Godzilla throws Zilla into the Sydney Opera House, and that's
it. It's the fastest fight in Godzilla history.
Apparently, the original plan was to actually do a big fight because it's like old school Godzilla versus CG Godzilla, and then they were running out of time and money and said, fuck it, we'll make it a joke.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
The teleportation effect, by the way, I hate it.
Oh, it's not good.
It's like something out of like early 2000, like late 90s, early 2000s TV shows for kids.
Yeah, it's
this kind of like rotating effect. It just looks so terrible. Yeah.
Let's see here.
Hedora's in L.A.
Yeah.
Like we said, Rodan's in New York. It just goes from city to city.
He actually fights Rodan and King Caesar and Angerus.
And Angerus. Together. Oh, that's right. All at the same
because
time.
Because all of them were actually his allies in previous movies, and which is why they're the only monsters Godzilla fights in this movie that we don't actually see him kill.
Yeah, he defeats
them, but they don't die on screen. That's the respect that they get.
Well, it's actually a little bit more mercenary than that. I was doing a little reading up, and they wanted to have Godzilla breathe his fire and kill those three monsters.
They didn't want to wreck the suits.
They said, we're not going to set the suits on fire. We need them for, like, publicity purposes.
Yeah.
So don't set them on fire. And all right, well. So
you could have found a way to make it clear that Godzilla killed them.
We like to think that it was for sentimental reasons, but it was really a little bit more mercenary.
Let me have this. Anguirus has had a hard enough time for the last 40 years.
Anguirus gets batted around like a ball. It's kind of fun.
It's cool. Like, Godzilla, because Anguirus in this one, like, can, like, roll up like an armadillo and gets, like, chucked around at Godzilla. All that stuff is fun. That part's great. I had a good time. Let's see here. Godzilla impales the mantis on a power line.
That's right.
Flings smites the spider for a while and flings it around. I forget who says it, but I wrote down, this Godzilla guy is one tough dude.
Somebody said that in the
American dub.
Oh, gosh.
And we do cut back to Manila. As he's being carted around in a little tiny truck by the grandfather and the grandkid. And he's the one who explains why does Godzilla hate us? And he says, Godzilla cannot forgive mankind. This will be important later. I also like that before Godzilla fights Anguirus, they actually talk for a minute. We don't get like subtitles like we did in the past, but it's like they recognize each other. Game recognizes game. Let's see here. There's more monsters.
More monsters. Great. Point is, we end up in Tokyo. This is where it all kind of comes down.
Yeah.
The ship from Atragon does the Star Wars thing, burrows into the side of the Zillion ship, which looks a little bit like a Death Star.
Yeah.
That's where we get the Star Wars stuff.
And they infiltrate the ship, and that's when the Zillions revealed all of their big plans, and they explain that the reason they couldn't control that one mutant is because he was a special Kaiser mutant. Who is more powerful than the others, and it's very cool, I assure you.
They don't really explain what a Kaiser mutant is.
It's just basically a reason why he's not a bad guy. Like, they just had to come up with some fucking reason.
But Kaiser is this film's sort of supra word.
Yeah.
Because we're going to meet a Kaiser monster in a minute here.
Yes, we are. The big ultimate climactic fight. We've killed all the other monsters.
Well, just as the Exilians are being killed, they summon Gorath. The planet lands.
No, Gorath was a hologram.
Or
Gorath wasn't real. What happened is they summon, is it Monster X?
It's
Gigan and Monster X. Monster.
Gorath is like, was inside the planet that was coming toward Earth. That was Monster X.
Oh, was that what it was?
And Godzilla blasted it and Monster X came.
X came out. I get it. Okay, so the idea that it was a planet was fake. It was actually a monster that was coming.
There was a monster,
Monster X. And Monster X is this, you know, evil-looking monster. We haven't seen it yet. We haven't seen it, like, before in the series. Or have we? And Godzilla is now fighting Super Chainsaw Guy again and Monster X. But good news, help is on the way. Mothra, because of course it's Mothra. Mothra comes back. Mothra, you know, Mothra puts out a good fight. Does some cool Mothra stuff.
Turns into a big flaming Mothra and crashes into Chainsaw Guy again.
It's good stuff. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a good time.
Again, this should sound more fun, but they're in such a rush to do all of this stuff that
no
single fight feels very interesting or dynamic. It feels like we're just sort of recapping a lot of this stuff.
I feel like
it's not really well paced.
I feel like it's Godzilla versus Megaguirus and Godzilla against Mechagodzilla. And honestly, to a lesser extent, GMK. Kind of raised the bar when it came to the monster fights.
Like actual choreography. Like,
choreography, elaborate, good sense of scale, paced well.
Yeah.
Memorable moves. Yeah. I feel like Ryuhei Kitamura's style is so choppy, fast-paced...
kind of rock and roll music video.
Yeah, and that's an aesthetic, don't get me wrong. I've never seen a movie that was good that was made that way. But it's not doing these fights any favors, unfortunately. And it just doesn't... It isn't making much of an impact, but... Godzilla and Mothra are fighting the monsters. Mothra dies.
Mothra gets set on fire, but crashes into Gigan and kills
it. Yeah, so Mothra takes out Gigan. Well done, Mothra.
Here's something I appreciate about this movie. Gigan always had that weird, like, red eyepiece.
Yeah, like a Battlestar Galactica.
Like a mechanical kind of eye. It's kind of a cyborg bird thing.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me if you have a big red eyepiece. Yeah. Lasers need to come out of it. That's my little kid logic.
Again, we're inspired by X-Men. He's got a Cyclops visor.
So
go like nuts. Although Cyclops has force blasts, not lasers.
Potato, potato, sir.
I'm sorry. No, that's potato turnip. Those are two different things. They have similar qualities, but they're two different vegetables.
I was thinking more of Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Fair enough.
That kind of eye beam.
Fair enough.
Clearly Ryuhei Kitamura shares that view because he finally gave Gigan an eye laser.
I love me some Gigan.
Yeah.
Gigan's my favorite evil monster.
Do you like this Gigan?
This Gigan's cool. I wish the Gigan had, like, an opportunity to have personality. Because that's what I liked about Gigan. It's like, a lot of the monsters that we've seen are, you know, they're scary monsters, they're evil or whatever like that. But they don't actually show a personality.
Yeah.
The thing with Gigan is Gigan had a particular attitude that no other monster had. He wasn't just evil.
Yeah,
he was a dick. Like, he actually, like, there were unspoken rules of engagement when Kaijus fought. And Gigan broke all of them. He was just a dick. And I loved that about him. The rules could not hold Gigan. So I'm fine with how they did Gigan. That's cool. But when the heroes defeat the Exilians, the bad guy shoves all of his power into Monster X, and Monster X becomes Kaiser Ghidorah. And he shoots two new heads out of his neck.
Yeah,
and grows wings.
The transformation is pretty cool. It looks like a combination of Mecha King Ghidorah from Godzilla vs. King Ghidorah and Desk Ghidorah from Rebirth of Mothra 1 or 2.
Desk Ghidorah,
the four-legged one.
Yeah, which is the gold. The gold standard of proper Ghidorah is the Rebirth of Mothra Desk Ghidorah. The greatest Ghidorah, of course, is Mecha Ghidorah.
Yeah,
which is just fucking awesome. And apparently they wanted to put him in this, but they thought it made more sense to do it this way. Kaiser Ghidorah bites Godzilla and starts sucking out his radiation like a vampire.
Yeah, right on the neck.
Which is cool. That is an actually cool thing. And they're realizing, shit, Godzilla's dying. We have to supercharge Godzilla.
So they shoot radiation into his back with the Atragon.
And Godzilla... You know, kicks his bath, and he atomic breaths Kaiser Ghidorah into outer space. And now, Godzilla is turning his attention to the humans because he still hasn't forgiven them. By the way, I'm not 100% sure of this, but I'm reasonably confident that the heroes at the end of this movie, and there's like 7 of them, are the last human beings on Earth. Like, I'm reasonably confident that the only human beings left on this planet are the ones in this scene. There is total devastation in a way that we haven't seen in other gods. They always seem like, okay, these buildings are destroyed or this city is destroyed, but otherwise Japan is fine, right? I think the entire planet got fucked in this movie. And it's just these 7. And I think the humanity is going to die out. And that, you know what? We had our chance. So...
I wish, if that were the case, I would love for the final shot to have been, you know, Godzilla's triumphant roar over a ruined Earth.
He won. Like, that would be cool, right? But he's about to destroy all of these humans. And I love that these humans, like, as Godzilla's approaching them, like, Mayor Hagar, like, pulls out his samurai sword, and the humans pick out their, like, pistols, and they're like, what are you gonna do?
I'm going to shoot his toenail.
He's not going to respect you for that. Like, it's not going to be like, aw, they're trying. Well, no, I can't kill him.
Better like a cat with a mouse.
Like, I admire their moxie. Like, no. But what does stop Godzilla from killing them is this paid off. Manila showed up. Uh-huh. And Manila walks in front of the humans, and Manila outstretches his arms like Jesus, and says, "We must forgive the humans for their sins." And Godzilla's like, "Fine. I can't say no to you, Manila." And then Godzilla walks off into the sunset. Manila walks off after it, and everyone's like, "Cool." And then
and that's the movie.
Yeah, and then Godzilla roars right at the camera, as if to say, "That's all, folks." And then we're done.
This movie bombed. It was not a success.
It was very polarizing. There are people who thought it was cool, and people who hated it.
I've made no mystery of how I feel about this movie. I don't like the way it's filmed. I don't like the pacing of it. The references are fun, but they're really just sloppily thrown at me rather than
a given few of them any are clever, organic... but mostly it's pretty sloppy.
Yeah, they're not given any kind of like organic reason. It feels like they were trying to pay homage rather than tell a story or make like an interesting movie.
Well, again, the structure I think of this movie is fine. Okay, so aliens show up.
It's the same plot as Invasion of Astro Monsters.
Fine, I don't mind remaking that, and just we've already had Godzilla against Mechagodzilla was practically a remake of Megaguirus. We talked about that a bunch. I don't mind revisiting that plot, especially when you're going to goose it up this much. So basically, we're basically taking Invasion of Astro Monster, but the second half is destroy all monsters. That's not a bad pitch.
Yeah.
Like, go for it. Like, knock yourself out. Like, you know, the aliens attack America, the planet is surrounded by monsters now, and they have to force Godzilla to fight all the other, like, all the monsters, like a battle royale. That's a perfectly good pitch for a Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. It's not blowing anyone's minds with its creativity, but it's gonna give you what you want. I want to see Godzilla fight all the monsters.
Yeah.
That is a good pitch. The execution does not work. It is, and part of it is, it's just of its time, and, you know...
Everything's gonna date. Yeah. We actually had a listener write in once. We answered a letter about defining what makes a movie timeless.
Yeah, what makes it stand the test of time.
Stand the test of time, and a lot of it has to do with... not necessarily needing some sort of cultural context or understanding of aesthetics at the time to still get into it. Like, you can get into it at any era.
Is it trying to hit a really contemporary zeitgeist?
Yeah.
If it is, there's a decent chance it's going to age badly because it's trying to follow what is currently popular rather than just tell a story and the aesthetics emerge out of that.
Yeah.
And this definitely does feel like the early 2000s new metal post-Matrix aesthetics was thrust upon the movie rather than emerging organically from the movie.
I was reminded of actually a movie I kind of like, Halloween H2O. The seventh Halloween picture, but it's, you know, like a lot of Godzilla movies, a reboot where we ignored a lot of the sequels.
It ignored everything but Halloween and Halloween 2.
Three, four, five, and six didn't exist in that universe, but seven did.
Yeah.
And but that movie came shortly after the release of Scream.
Yes.
And Scream really changed the way those kinds of movies were being made, the way a lot of dialogue was being written, and it feels very contemporaneous. It feels like really up to the minute in terms of when it came out, which was 1997.
Right.
That movie, however, still functions well as a slasher movie.
Yeah.
Even without, you know, knowing what the trends were. It feels really kind of apart from a lot of the Halloween movies.
Yeah.
Because it was chasing the trends.
But those trends
lasted.
The thing about Scream is that the thing about Scream that would make it really dated was the meta humor. That's fine, but like you're dating yourself as this is when those movies were out. Halloween H2O doesn't do the meta Scream stuff. What it does is we're going to treat this slasher movie like almost like a small town drama in which a slasher attacks. And so H2O takes Laurie Strode's story as seriously as Scream takes Sidney Prescott's story. And I think that's why that movie actually works really well. I think H2O is really, really good. There's bits of it that don't work. There's like one bit where they CG'd Michael Myers' mask on, it looks terrible, but mostly it's really good. Just because it's contemporary doesn't mean it will age badly, but it does. I do think it means your odds of becoming dated and feeling like it's only going to work in context escalate. I look at something like the original Thomas Crown Affair with Steve McQueen and Faye Dunaway, which is, it's considered a classic, but you look at it now, just the massive amounts of split screen, the really slow romantic scenes, the, like, it just has such a 60s aesthetic. It cannot be extricated from the 60s. It's one of the reasons why I like the remake with Pierce Brosnan and Rene Russo better. It just feels like a classy heist movie that's not trying to be the 90s.
Yeah.
You know? But again, a lot of these Godzilla movies are a product very specifically of their time, and being aware of what was going on at the time can enhance the experience, if only because you know a bit more about what it's referencing, but sometimes it adds valuable dramatic context and makes them better. This is a case where, unfortunately, the trends that it was following were shallow trends.
Yeah.
Like, The Matrix had depth, but the thing that people tend to rip off...
is all the surface-level stuff.
Yeah, the surface-level stuff is what's easy to rip off, not the depth. The depth is hard to rip off, because then you have to put effort into it. But any movie, you can just shove people into leather jackets.
Right.
That's easy. So that's what they did. And here, you've got, you know, you got the mutants from X-Men, you got the elaborate, you know, CG-assisted fights. You've got, like, this. It just doesn't have anything resembling the substance that made The Matrix genuinely great.
Yeah.
And as a result, this just feels like a shallow Godzilla movie. And even then, I will say this. When the monster action kicks in, I had a better time. And I genuinely think that the last hour of this movie is at least twice as good as the first hour. But the first hour sucks. The first hour is not good filmmaking. I've liked Ryu Kitamura's other movies. The first half of this movie does not work. It just has nothing to do with anything. Like, it doesn't even, like, when the Godzilla finally kicks in, like, oh, this is why we were doing this. No. But we didn't need the mutants at all. Like, that really didn't go anywhere. You could cut that out, and with only a few dialogue changes, the plot of the movie would be the same.
More or less.
Yeah.
It's weird. So even by your own estimation, this just averages out to be kind of an okay movie.
Oh, yeah. At best, this is okay. But it's not okay because it's okay all the way through. It's okay because it's bad for an hour and pretty good for the second hour.
I'll say this. I'm glad I rewatched the Millennium Era movies. Because I remember being very down on all of them the first time I went through the Millennium Era. I've gained a new appreciation for Megaguirus and against Mechagodzilla. Those are very good movies.
Right.
But watching them now, I am seeing Godzilla contracting before my eyes. They rebooted Godzilla. We're going to give him new life. And I just started to sense this kind of scrambling to do what they could rather than being inspired by having new Godzilla stories to tell or an enthusiasm.
We have to for exploit the IP. Yeah. It wasn't because we had something we wanted to do.
Today, as of this recording, there was an article in Variety about Star Trek. And it was an interview with the executive producers of Star Trek, people like Alex Kurtzman and Akiva Goldsman, who are in charge of Star Trek right now. All of their, everything they said about Star Trek, all of their quotes that were put in this Variety article were about how valuable Star Trek was as a property.
Yeah. That's a business article.
They talked a little bit about, yes, and it has these messages, and we want Star Trek to remain relevant to modern. It was all ad copy.
Yeah.
It was all
it was in a trade.
It was in a trade.
Yeah.
But we were supposed to be inspired by that. Like, it's just an article that fans are going to read. Oh, this is going to make me excited to see what they have to say about Star Trek in the future. And it was just about, oh, yeah, we were going to exploit it in this way, and we have this IP, and we need to tell these kinds of stories to keep a certain segment of fans involved so we can get subscriber. And it was like, so... it wasn't that it was dry, it's that it was so mercenary.
Well, yeah, because there's two types of, like, industry... interviews or articles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's ones that are intended for the people who watch movies, which tend to be a bit more artistically inclined, caring more about quality. And then there's the ones for the people who are investing in movies, for the shareholders.
Yeah.
All they're concerned about is making money. I'm sure they were concerned about other things, but at the end of the day, they're there to make money.
Yeah.
And they need to know that what you're doing is going to be lucrative. What I took exception to in that article was the stipulation that they had that, because there have been 900 episodes of Star Trek and 13 Star Trek movies since 1966.
66, yeah.
Star Trek was the longest continuously running, like, story in media. Like, it hadn't been, like, rebooted, or if it did, it was part of it because it went time travel. You know, it didn't start over from scratch. And they were all very, very proud of this. And bullshit. That's wrong. That is literally inaccurate. I'll tell you why. General Hospital debuted 3 years before, 3 years before Star Trek, is still on the air, was never canceled, unlike Star Trek, had multiple spin-offs. The spin-offs weren't as popular as Star Trek. Never had a movie. But you're proud of, and you should be, 900 episodes and 13 movies. There have been 15,000 episodes of General Hospital, and they're still telling the same story. With the same characters or their descendants in the same town. I'm sorry, man. You have to accept defeat. I realize that people don't think soap operas are cool, and maybe they never were.
Yeah.
But they're real. They exist. In fact, and pretending they don't is, well, frankly, mean and ahistorical.
And General Hospital only debuted on TV before Star Trek.
Fair point.
Was actually going on radio before that.
Were there also theatrical
shorts even prior to the TV series?
I don't think they were theatrical. I could be wrong about that. I don't think they were theatrical shorts. But
I know it's been running since like the 50s. It's been around for a long time.
My mom, I think it was As the World Turns, my mom listened to on the radio before it debuted on the air on TV. But the thing is, there's only like three, I think, daytime soap operas, especially from the classic era, that are still going strong. I think it's General Hospital, The Young and the Restless, and Bold and the Beautiful. I think those are still going.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but I think that's those three. And with the exception, I think, of Bold and the Beautiful, which I think is newer than the other two, they've all been going on for, like, at least 40 years.
So, I just looked it up on my phone here.
Yeah.
General Hospital is the third longest-running scripted drama in TV history.
Yeah.
It is still behind The Archers and Coronation Street.
Wow.
Then General Hospital.
But these are soap operas.
Yeah, these are all soaps.
Yeah. And I think my point is this. There are other soap operas, like As the World Turns, which got canceled, I think, like 10 years ago now, maybe more, still had more episodes than Star Trek.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, you just...
Soap operas were daily shows. They were on such a breakneck schedule.
My mom never understood my interest in, like, comics. It just wasn't for her. And it's fine. It didn't have to be. It's totally fine. But the thing that I kept trying to explain to her was, you watch As the World Turns. And there's a lot of bullshit melodrama in As the World Turns. And I loved As the World Turns, but there's a lot of bullshit melodrama.
The writers have to keep on coming up with new reasons and new dramas for these characters to live through.
Yeah.
And keep them as part of the show. Yeah.
Really, the serialized stories of the X-Men and Spider-Man are only different in genre.
Yeah.
In structure and everything, we're doing the same shit over and over again.
They are soaps.
Yeah. And that's fine. That is totally fine. I think we have to respect that. Much like we respect Godzilla, it has been rebooted and changed over the years, but it's still going. It's still Godzilla, goddammit. Good for them.
Of course, watching Final Wars, I was like, I'm glad this was over.
Well, then they weren't all winners.
Yeah.
They weren't all winners. This is the last live-action Godzilla movie, again, for 10 years. Actually, it was the last Godzilla movie of any kind, actually.
Of any kind, yeah.
Godzilla after this.
Godzilla the Animated Series? No, that was already off the air by now.
No, that was off. Yeah. That was the American Animated Series was off the air. The next Godzilla movie, which we will be reviewing next week, is the first MonsterVerse movie, where it was the Gareth Edwards Godzilla, and it was 10 years later in 2014. There was one appearance of Godzilla in the middle there. That we're not covering because it's like a dream sequence. But to be thorough, I will name check it. It's in a movie called Always, Sunset on 3rd Street 2 from 2007, which I've never seen. It's my understanding they're like comedies or dramas about people like working at like a mechanic shop or like for an auto company.
Japanese series?
Yeah, movie. Okay. Movie.
Oh, movie, okay.
The opening of the second film begins with the characters from the first movie having to evacuate because Godzilla is attacking their town.
Cute. All right.
And it turns out, like, after, like, a minute and a half of that, and it looks pretty good. Godzilla's, like, kind of cool looking and everything. It turns out that's actually, like, a guy writing fan fiction about his family, and a guy, like...
Oh, that hardly counts, yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't count. That's not canon. That's a dream sequence. It doesn't count. The same way the Coke commercial doesn't count. So, like, a kid says, Dad, that's ridiculous. Don't write that. So, like, fine. Good. I'm glad. We'll name check it. It happened, but that's not Godzilla. That's a dream. The next proper Godzilla experience we'll have is Godzilla 2014, and we'll review that in the next episode of Think Godzilla It's Friday. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We're on the last leg.
Yeah, we've entered the ended the Millennium Era.
Yep.
The MonsterVerse is the MonsterVerse.
Yeah, it's the American, but we're also the successful American Godzilla franchise.
There's going to be three different continuities in the new Japanese era, which we're going to call the Reiwa Era.
Yeah.
The eras, by the way, are named after Japanese emperors.
Yeah. Well, except for the Millennium Era.
Yeah, didn't have a... Yeah. Just called the Millennium. But yeah, we're going to... In addition to the MonsterVerse, we're going to be interspersing that a little bit with the animated films. A trilogy of animated films set in the distant future. Then Shin Godzilla, and then Godzilla Minus One.
Yes, yeah. And I haven't seen the animated ones.
Okay.
But I have seen the others, and I haven't revisited, I think, any of them. I think I've only seen them the one time, so this should be interesting. Yeah, I have strong opinions about some of them, but maybe they'll change.
These MonsterVerse films, I saw these all in theaters just recently, in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I didn't revisit them. Mm-hmm. Have varying degrees of fondness for them, so we'll see how I feel on a rewatch.
What I think is interesting about the legendary movies, and we'll see how true this is, how much I remember it. I feel like, because there's many different takes on Godzilla, but basically it boils down to, do you have a serious take on Godzilla or a silly take?
Mm.
And sometimes there's a little bit of both. But there's, like, Shin Godzilla and Godzilla Minus One and Gojira. And then you have, like...
Godzilla versus Megalon.
Yeah, exactly. Or when you fight... Yeah, exactly. The ridiculous ones.
The Jun Fukuda films.
Yeah, basically. And there's nothing wrong with them, per se. It's just a very different take. I feel like the Legendary MonsterVerse wanted to be serious. And we got that really intense first Godzilla movie. And we got a King Kong movie that was, like, also spliced really with Apocalypse intense, Now. Yeah. And then they realized that's not what they're good at. And they got sillier and sillier. And it's almost like what happened to James Bond. Like, the first couple of James Bond movies were super serious, but by the time we got to Goldfinger, it's absurd.
Well, here's what I've liked about certain life cycles in long-running entertainment series like this.
Yeah.
James Bond, we're going to start and be really serious, but we realize pretty quickly that this is an absurd premise, and we're going to start rolling with that really quick. And as soon as we realize, we got too silly, we have to... panic. We have to start being serious again real quick.
Yeah.
But the series inexorably starts creeping back into its inherent underlying silliness.
Yeah.
Same thing happened with Batman.
Sure.
Tim Burton came along and made this really intense, stylized version of Batman. Three films later, we have Batman and Robin, where Joel Schumacher made it big and colorful like the 1960s show.
Sure.
We're just sort of creeping back into something enjoyably light and silly.
Yeah.
Godzilla all the time. We start with it serious. We reboot it. We're going to start it. It's going to be serious and tragic and destructive. By the time we're getting to, like, multiple monster fights, it's ridiculous again.
I feel like there's it's hard to deny after you've made a couple in a row.
Yeah.
When your premise is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And look, let's be fair here. There's some really great serious Godzilla movies that are just genuine classics. They're deep. They're meaningful. They're resonant. They're historically significant. They're great movies. But at its core... It's a giant lizard punching buildings.
It's pretty absurd premise. Just silly images.
It is absurd. And after a while, it's just hard to pretend that it's not.
Yeah.
And you just want to lean into it. And I can't blame you for that.
I think a big issue with those Marvel pictures is they haven't found a way to go back to being serious or to lean into the silliness.
No, they're afraid
to
do
both. And they kind of vacillate a little bit. Yeah. And even within a movie, it's like the characters are all really, like, sarcastic and self-aware and comment on how wild it is. But then they take the fight really seriously anyway.
Well, they did this thing where you lose your connection to reality after a while. Yeah. Where it's like the world was real and then there was an Iron Man.
Mm.
And then there was a Thor. And then there was a Captain America. And for a little bit, you can get away with that. Hmm. But by the time half the universe has died and come back to life, whether they were superheroes or not, and all of this other shit has happened, there's time travel, She-Hulk can break the fourth wall and walk into the Disney Plus app, which I enjoyed, but let's be honest here, we've gone so far we can't come back. They're not in the real world anymore. They're in a completely ridiculous world. You either need to just embrace that their world is absurd, and that's fine, or you need to scale it way the fuck back somehow, and they are afraid to do either one of those things.
Yeah.
And they're trying to ride the fence, and people don't know how invested we're supposed to be anymore.
Mm.
Because every time we start getting invested, because, like, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 is actually kind of intense sometimes and really works for the most part, then we go back to nonsense land. And it's like, I don't know how much I'm supposed to care. Or the time when you are supposed to care, like Secret Invasion was, like, super intense and broody. But then the next time you see Nick Fury, he's a wacky quipster with alien cats. And it's like, I can't... You're asking us to get invested. You're begging us to get invested. And you're punishing us for it by having... By just not working. It just... anyway, it's a whole thing. But honestly, maybe constant reboots are the way to go. Because you have permission to change.
Either reboots or, consider this... retiring it.
Yeah, that will literally never happen.
Putting it away forever and not coming back to something.
There aren't a lot of genuinely popular, mainstream popular franchises that go away.
Yeah, well...
There's a few.
It looked like it was going to be that way for a long time with something like The Matrix. But then we entered this era where we're rebooting everything.
They had to exploit it.
And they had to do a number four. His fraudulent 20-year late sequels.
And they'll keep doing it even if there's no history of success. Like, The Lone Ranger hadn't been popular in, like, well over 50 years. Mm. And after, like, about two, maybe... I forget when the TV show went off the air, but, like, after about two, maybe three decades... They're like, hey, let's do a movie. Mm. And they did a movie in the early 80s.
That's right.
And it was a disastrous bomb that nobody liked. And it lost a ton of money. And then 30 years later, Disney was like, hey, let's bring the Lone Ranger back. People remember that name. Yeah. And that was also a huge bomb. And I guarantee you that just because that is an intellectual property that people can own, someone's going to try it again.
Well, this is something I really appreciate. First of all, Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey sucks. It is just an aggressively terrible movie.
Just incompetent, really.
I'm not going to complain about the premise. It was supposed to be absurd. That's the joke of the movie.
Yeah.
It was the terrible filmmaking, horrible acting, bad storytelling that I'm objecting to. It's just a bad picture. The
costumes were awful. Yeah. Nothing about it was good.
Even the monster masks were bad. Yeah. But I appreciate that these things exist.
Sure.
This whole new Winnie the Pooh monster verse that they're setting up. Because the makers of those have the punk rock trauma-like temerity.
Yeah.
To take something that was corporately owned for so long and just wrest it from the hands of the previous owners and...
Drag it through the shit.
Like shove it in a latrine. It's like, this is what we think of your shit. It is shit. And is that mature? No. Does it have to be? No. It's immaturity is where it's getting its power.
Immaturity can be very, very valuable if it's weaponized.
Yeah.
If it's immature because it's trying to, like... ruffle no feathers. They're not really doing anything, but immaturity with like a point can be really, really great.
So I hated Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey, but I appreciate that it exists.
That was my review as well.
And so it's possible to just wait until something is in the public domain. Wait until it belongs to everyone.
Yeah.
Then you can do whatever you want with it.
Mm.
That way it belongs to us all. We're just sort of riffing on something that is part of now the culture. Not corporate culture, not a product that we're trying to keep alive. Just let it belong to the people.
I wonder how long until The Thin Man is in public domain. It's got to be pretty soon.
Probably not very long. And I know...
Because that's a franchise that was a huge hit that did go away.
And I know that we're looking at things like things that are still being sold, like things like Superman and Batman. These are characters that were created in the 30s. Let the people have them.
Yeah.
Just let them go.
Yeah.
That's the way to just let it die. We don't have to keep milking it for money. We can just let everybody have it.
We've been talking about shallow, empty fan service anniversary movies.
Yeah.
And we got one of the ultimate ones last year with Disney's Wish.
Which is a rotten picture.
It's a terribly made movie on almost every level. Mm-hmm. It's just the story doesn't make sense. The characters are bad. We went into great detail. That's not a great criticism. I'm just saying I don't like it. But the end of the movie makes the point. This is Disney's movie. That the best thing you can do for the things that people create and dream up is to release them into the public domain. Hmm. That is wrong.
The villain is hoarding people's dreams.
Inside
his magic kingdom. And he has them in these little balls that float around in his kingdom.
And we see that they're things like Mary Poppins and Peter Pan. They're actual stories.
Things that Disney owns. He owns these Disney stories. And in hoarding them, he is depicted as a villain. He becomes corrupt. He wants to keep them all for himself.
Yeah.
He starts cracking into, like, dark magic and becomes a evil wizard at some point.
He erases some of them just for his own personal gain. Mm. Like, and then the movie ends happily when they just give all the stories back to the people. And I'm like, does Disney know what they did?
They don't know what that movie's about.
I seriously think if someone poked them and said, you know, this is about how Disney is monopolizing intellectual property, right? And how that's the most evil thing you can do. I think that movie wouldn't have come out that way. Anyway. Thank you for listening to Thank Godzilla Friday.
It is possible.
Yes.
To let Godzilla go.
It would be a choice. I still think there's great Godzilla movie being made. This has been the last year.
Yeah.
To be fair.
It's
gone fallow for a while and people come in with new ideas. It can work. I'm for long-term serialized storytelling. I'm for returning to the same characters over and over again because there are still things you can do. Mm. You're going to run into a lot of chaff in that wheat.
Yeah.
But it can be worth it.
I'm just bristling because I just survived a decade where we did nothing but milk intellectual properties and reboot things and keep a lot of these old properties alive in the public consciousness.
And to be fair, we've always been doing that, but the last decade was particularly egregious.
I'm not saying that, it was novel in the last decade. It was just really, really bad. It was as bad as it was in the 80s.
The industry relied on it a lot more than it used to. Yeah.
And there was this movement to like start moving things into the permanent consciousness right away and turn them into theme parks. We have to keep on thinking about these things all the time and keeping the conversation going. Yeah. It was especially bad because we work in journalism, and that's been our job, is to keep the conversations alive. So we have to talk about them all the time, even if we're not interested. So the idea of letting a franchise end was such a relief. just dreaming of an end to a franchise.
Oh, I know.
When I see a movie like Logan, I'm like, yes. Let them die. Let them die. Let them realize that being a superhero is actually a tragic life.
So you're not excited to see him come back in Deadpool 3?
No, I'm not.
Okay. I suspected as much, but I thought maybe I'd ask just in case.
Maybe it'll be good. I want to keep... You know what? Maybe I'll be happy to eat my words if I love
that movie.
Wouldn't
it be great if the movie's good, right? Who knows? Yeah,
if I love the movie, I'll be happy to say so.
Anyway, this is one of our longest episodes, so we're going to cut it out. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Thank you for joining us. Thank Godzilla. It's Friday. We do still have... I think about a dozen. We got about 3 more months of the show to go.
Yeah, a few more.
So we'll be around. So if you want to listen to our future episodes ad-free and for Thank Godzilla It's Friday 1 week early, you can head on over to our Patreon. That's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, where in addition to all those things, you can also sign up at other tiers and get access to a lot of our libraries of Patreon-exclusive shows. And there are hundreds of episodes that are there for patrons exclusively. And we hope you enjoy them. Thank you to all of our patrons. We can't do this without you. It means the world to us. If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode, are you a huge Sum 41 fan and you're just mad at me right now, you can send us some correspondence. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Send us a physical letter to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. We're on the social medias. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
It's good stuff. And, we'll see you next time when Godzilla comes back, baby. Rawr!